Record show those in attendance are Senator Rohde, Senator Halpern, Senator Lee. We have before you CS for sponsor substitute for Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, Judiciary. We have not adopted this committee CS yet. Senator Pierce, who is not in attendance today, has requested the administration to give testimony on this bill. And would you come forward, sir, please? This is why this bill is before us today.
Oh, on this bill. I'm not here for this bill.
No, the Senate Joint Resolution 5. Jack.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry you're so far away, sir.
It seems very elegant. It's like dinner at someone else's home.
You go to different homes than I do.
Oh, no, this is strictly allegedly.
You lunch with a Senate, dear wife. Your line will be on the menu.
For the record, my name is Jack Farnioli. I'm the Chief Analyst of the Governor's Division of Policy. We're here by request, and my boss, Mary Halloran, is here supposedly to present it, but she was called away to Seattle last night and won't be back till tonight, so I'm hearing what she would like to be presented. Basically, our position, or the governor's position, is that he's not comfortable supporting the resolution, basically for two reasons. One is in the opening section of the bill, or the resolution, or the draft CS, I guess to be precise, but I think it's there in the earlier versions as well. At line 27, 22 in the CS, the draft CS, where the reference to establishment as a public trust is located, we have problems with that because it's not clear to us, even after discussions with the Department of Law, what the consequences of making that change would be. Specifically, we're not sure that it would have legal implications regarding transferring the ultimate ownership of the fund away from state government to the public. We're not certain what the consequences of that would be, both financially, legally, and managerially, frankly, looking down the road. So we're not, in the absence of any consensus on the legal side, we're demurring on our support for that particular provision of it.
Jack, what is the discussion among the governor's office that this was a recommendation from the permanent fund staff? This wasn't something that I dreamed up in the dark of the night. I mean, this was a recommendation from the staff, and I'm assuming you still are talking to one another.
I'm still talking with them. I assume, too, that it's still cordial. But it is, as I understand it, their recommendation, and is, as you know, they've always been quite specific about saying they've managed the assets as a public trust. But even while we don't fully concur with that position, there's certainly a difference between managing the assets as a public trust and legally establishing it as a public trust. And it's on that side of the issue that the governor is taking his position.
Do either members of the Judiciary Committee have any comments about this? I mean, I'm not wedded to this language at all. And certainly,
I like it.
Senator Halpern, you like it. Okay. Any other comments? Jack, you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. I don't have much more, really only one other point, and that is the question of inserting the formula into the Constitution. This is something that's come up before, and the governor's position remains the same on that. So I won't belabor that. That's his main concern about it during the period of fiscal uncertainty that we're looking at and being basically to be irretrievable for any other use, therefore limiting our options. And so he demurs on supporting for that reason, both in the location where the formula itself is presented in the draft and also in the treatment of the surpluses in the spending limit section, both above and below the affected spending limit, the putting of those basically about 50% in each case into the permanent fund. Would be removing degrees of flexibility we might otherwise have a need. That's basically the sum of our position.
But it's my understanding the governor does support the portion which would allow earnings to flow into general government through the budget reserve account.
Right. That's I have no indication to think that he does not.
Right. Right. And I don't think the governor has particular problems. I know he doesn't like the formula being in the Constitution, but because it sunsets in 5 years, I think that helps a little bit towards that point of view that it's just a five-year vehicle and then it goes away and the issue becomes before us again, and we could have a large savings account there.
That's definitely, I concur with you there, that's definitely a plus side to it. The governor's position is that there's an unusual nature to the 5 years in particular that we're looking at in the draft, and that is that they may be years of particularly high volatility of revenues and budgetary needs, etc.
Okay, are there any questions for Jack? Thank you very much, Jack. Appreciate you coming by, and sorry we missed Mary today.
Okay.
Okay, and listen, for the information, I'm hoping that this bill will go to the Finance Committee. I know that the governor isn't, you know, doesn't love the thing 100% of the way, but we're trying to make it compatible to meet lots of different needs. If you folks have some suggested amendments that we could pass on to the Finance Committee, or when the bill starts getting worked on in the Finance Committee, I would appreciate knowing those. And I think if you could talk with your permanent fund folks on that trust issue, that's something that also could be debated up there.
That's something we'll definitely do on both fronts. So
okay.
I'll make sure that they get that and see if I'll have something to allow us to submit for an amendment.
Thank you, Jack, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on Senate Joint Resolution Number 5? Senator Hopper, I need a motion to adopt the CS.
I move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the CS 6-0161M 33189.
Is there any objections to adopting the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution Number 5? Without objections, that Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, dated 33189, will be adopted. Is there any other discussion, gentlemen? I don't like not having a full committee here, but that's the deck I was dealt with today. Senator Rohde?
Just a brief comment that I, too, have a question about what the full implications of having the fund managed as a trust practicing and practice law in that area. I really don't know what the full ramifications are of the public trust. Perhaps the permanent fund and the Attorney General's office could look into that question. It is an extremely detailed question, and the area of public trust law is quite complex.
I think you're making a good point. What we did is working with the permanent fund folks. As you know, they don't take a stand on things, but they're very, very good at giving information and giving charts and graphs and things. They requested this specifically. They made several suggestions, and they really felt quite strongly that they wanted this language inserted in the bill, and I was just trying to be particularly compatible with them, quite frankly, not doing any research into the full extent of the law. I think what it does is it protects it even further from legislative or executive branch tampering. It just strengthens the whole idea of the permanent fund amendment. But again, it's up for the committee to decide here.
Madam Chairman, the essence of the bill is or put differently, 80% of the bill deals with financial questions.
Yes.
I have no objection to the bill moving from committee to go to finance. It would not be on the ballot until next year,
right.
And presumably it wouldn't be passing out of finance until next year. That would allow the committee and the sponsors adequate opportunity to research the question.
I will ask staff then to, Cheryl, if you will research this and find out exactly what we're doing here. I think it's fair, and I think it's a fair question. It's come up every time. And I sure haven't focused on it, because my problem was focusing on saving or giving to the people 80% and then using 20% of the monies for general government expenditures. So that's what I always focused on. And I did this for the permanent fund folks without doing adequate research on it, Senator.
I followed the various formulas and over the past several years, and they all tend to sound alike, much like household cleaning detergents.
You're right. All right, can I have
I just wonder if this is the committee that's a better committee to have the permanent fund actually come in and say why they need it. And why do they want it to be a trust?
There's no problem. If you want to have the permanent fund folks come in and do this, I have no problems with holding that and doing it. What I think the problem is there's not a good consensus in the executive branch. And I think we could be putting the permanent fund folks on the line with this, but otherwise we can hold it until Thursday and do it. That's fine. We'll do this piece by piece, sir. Isn't it?
My inclination is that
I think you both have a good
It's a legal
point.
Question.
Yeah, it's a legal question. Senator Rohde brought it up, and if there's no problem, we'll just hold this CS in committee until Thursday. Okay, that's fair. I don't want sloppy work coming out of this committee, whether it's mine or somebody else's. I don't want sloppy work. So, and Senator Rohde's right.
It is going to be on the schedule for Thursday.
It'll be on the schedule for Thursday.
I just want to.
No problem. No problem. And I'm straight up about that. Senate Bill 225 is an act relating to access to criminal records and providing for an effective date. This is a Senator Duncan bill, It was on the schedule for last week. We ran out of time and didn't get it. Now, in all fairness to my committee staff and to all of us, Senator Duncan's staff at 12:55 today brought us a proposed CS. So you've got your CS in your packets. I have the differences marked in yellow. We have Senator Duncan's staff here. Maybe he needs to come up here, go over, she needs to come up here, go over, you have two of you here. He has too many staffers. Okay, give us the background. Tell us what you're trying to do on the original bill, and then tell us how you were working on the CS and what you've come up with.
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roxanne Stewart. I'm an aide to Senator Duncan. And in the original bill, what we were and are doing in the CS also is expanding the crimes which can be reported to school districts and other employers. Presently, state law only allows crimes of contributing to the delinquency of a minor and sex crimes to be reported to potential employers. These crimes can be revealed only if a person would be hired in a position with direct supervisory or disciplinary power over a minor. Senator Duncan feels it is appropriate that the criminal records of all potential employees who work around children be available for review by school districts and other employers. This legislation will address a problem which recently became an issue in Juneau. The situation dealt with a person who was hired as a substitute teacher, even though that person had pled no contest to selling cocaine in Ketchikan. In checking on that particular issue, I found a lot of areas which needed strengthening in the current system of records checking. The current Senate Bill 225 will broaden the kinds of employees for which criminal records can be requested to include all school district employees, regardless of their supervisory role over children. I do not feel that there is any reason for us to take unnecessary risk when hiring school personnel. State agencies and school districts are added to the definition of interested person to allow the Department of Education teacher certification section to receive and review teachers' criminal records and clarify the right of school districts to receive and review all school district employees' records. Senate Bill 225 requires the Department of Ed to review criminal records as a part of the initial teacher certification process. Presently, the teacher certification section in the Department of Education is responsible for reviewing and certifying a teacher's qualifications, but each school district must independently request a check of potential teachers' criminal records. The information I have from the Department of Ed is that only 7 of the larger school districts routinely do records checks on teachers prior to employment. Since in many cases teachers apply for certification by the Department of Education prior to applying for a job at a particular school district, this bill will require that a records check be done by the Department of Education at that time. Having the criminal records check done centrally will eliminate duplicate checks done by school districts when a teacher applies at more than one district. Now I'll address the committee substitute. On page 1, line 12, the Department of Public Safety is substituted for a commission because the Governor's Commission on the Administration of Justice, which is referred to in the statute, is currently inactive. So the Department of Public Safety actually performs the records check, and that change is also made on page 1, line 18. On lines 12 through 14, instead of including all criminal convictions, to ensure that only crimes which might affect a person's ability to work with children are reported, the change is to allow the disclosure of all felony convictions and all drug-related convictions and continuing the current disclosure of contributing to the delinquency and sex crimes. And then in the definitions of contributing to the delinquency of the minor and sex crimes are the same as are in current law with definition of interested person, which is amended as it was in the original bill to allow state agencies to do checking.
Okay, Roxanne, let me just go over this, and we'll just continue this public hearing. We've lost our quorum, but we're going to continue and take all the testimony, and hopefully somebody will come back. In the first bill, you had all crimes,
yes,
right? And this one, you've narrowed it down to felonies. Okay,
so two felonies.
But any felony, just sex crimes.
Right, any felony, any sex crime, any contributing to delinquency, and any misconduct involving a controlled substance.
Okay, so you really have been specific then. It's not broad, you've narrowed it down.
Right.
Okay, all right. Then the other thing you did is you broadened who has to be checked here. So it's not just teachers directly involved with the children. It's supervisory personnel, and it's just anybody with supervisory or disciplinary power. So it'd be all the principals.
It's anybody that works in the school district.
Anybody who works in the school district.
Right.
Janitors?
Yes.
Okay. All righty. And then you have, you redefine interested person to include school districts, REA, state agencies. I thought they could already do this, Roxanne.
State agencies were not previously included in an interested person.
So then you're just bringing them into the loop.
School districts could already do it. They were being allowed to do it, but they weren't specifically listed as an interested person.
Okay, and are you adding the part about the Department of Education requesting records?
Yes, we are. If you, the last section of the bill, section 3 in the CS.
Okay.
It would be the initial certification only. It would not be recertification, which occurs every 5 years.
All right. Okay, are there any questions, Senator Rudy?
No, I like the committee substitute.
I think the committee substitute is tremendously improved over the original bill.
We had a quorum, I would move it. The way, move it.
Right.
Yes, there are a number of people here.
Yeah, who wish to testify.
Sure.
Okay, anything else, Roxanne? All right, you might want to stay with us at the table in case there's some questions. Mr. Hole from the Department of Education. And we do have a fiscal note, and that's good of you to be here to go over that. Is there any questions? You have a fiscal note, Roxanne, from the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Hole, do you have any, is there a Department of Ed position paper on this bill?
Madam Chairman, no, we don't have a position paper. We do support the bill.
You do support the bill?
Yes.
Okay, for the record. Could we have a position paper then, sir, stating that?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd appreciate that, and I think it would make it more complete for the bill to move through the system. If somebody else doesn't ask you, they eventually will. And appreciate public safeties. All right, any questions for Mr. Hole, or do you have a statement, sir?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Manners, NEA. Ms. Retzke, are you going to testify on this bill?
I'd like to.
Maybe. Yes, ma'am, I'd like you to. Mr. Manners, it's fine, she didn't sign up.
My name is Bob Manners, I'm with NEA Alaska. We also support the legislation, and I want to emphasize the primary concept that makes it attractive to us, and that with the DOE as the interested party, we feel that it will lend itself to a better procedure in terms of the initial check and enhance the possibility that districts will have access to information. As Roxanne indicated in the testimony, only 7 school districts to date have utilized this, and so we would also like to emphasize that we feel that this should not be perceived as a substitute for the responsibilities of school boards and administrators to be rigorous in their own efforts to check the references and backgrounds of all prospective employees. We do not have a paper right, and I'm trying to go along right, but I would respond to questions if.
Mr. Manners, appreciate that. And for Steve Hole, here's your fiscal note for Department of Ed. All right. I was going to say, does it transfer the responsibility then from the local school districts to the Department of Education?
Yes, for the initial certification.
Okay, so there will be a savings on the part of all the local school districts, which is what you're saying.
There will be a savings, and we feel that it will probably be a more appropriate process than that with 55 districts
doing it
different ways.
Sure.
There is the risk of somebody's rights being trampled on in terms of one or two instances out there.
Okay.
So we feel it would be a better procedure.
Appreciate it. Thank you, sir. Any questions? Ms. Oretzky.
Madam Chair,
yes,
committee members, for the record, I'm Gail Horesky, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I apologize, Madam Chair, for not signing up. I know better than that. I don't know what happened.
Ms. Horesky, that's all right. We don't have a quorum, so, I mean, you're fine.
Rather important.
I, like the committee members, I apparently just received a copy of this. I've had a chance to go over it just briefly. I would reiterate the position paper we have submitted that the Department of Public Safety supports this bill. We are very supportive of the concept of people in general who employ daycare workers, babysitters, teachers, people in position of authority over children being able to find out if there is a criminal conviction that could potentially affect the safety of the children. I would suggest that the committee may want to consider on the CS on page 2, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Ms. Stewart about this yet, where it says interested person means a state agency, perhaps to clear up any potential questions, it could say state or municipal agency. the present definition of interested person, as interpreted by the Department of Public Safety, we have seen that as a very broad definition. I mean, it includes natural people, just anybody, as long as they meet the definition of interested person. So arguably that's not necessary, but if we're going to put state agency, then I can just see the argument coming, well, what about local agencies too? The only other thing I'd like to say, Madam Chair, is we will have to go back and take another look at our fiscal note. Our fiscal note was for all crimes, and ironically, the broader the scope of the bill, the easier it is for us to do, because then we don't have to do the screening and the retyping and, you know. So, but also I note that this is for just initial certification, and our fiscal note was for initial and recertification based on the numbers from Department of Education. So the numbers will go down, the screening requirements will go up. It may balance out, but we would just have to take a look at that.
Okay, well, that's fine. And I would ask Mr. Hole also to look at their fiscal note based on this committee substitute.
Yes, ma'am, we have.
Oh, okay.
Our fiscal note will go down.
Great, so we need two new fiscal notes then, or at least affirmation of your fiscal note, and then Department of Ed's looks like it's going to go down. Okay, great. We had a Roxanne, how do you feel about adding or municipal on line one of page 8?
It sounds like a good idea.
No problem. Okay.
Can I answer any questions?
Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm expecting a new fiscal note or a reaffirmation from you and a new fiscal note from you. Okay? Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? I have no one else signed up. Yes, ma'am, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't sign up either.
That's all right.
My name is Elaine Hobson, and I'm personnel director at the Juneau School District.
Oh.
The Juneau District happens to be one of those that does fingerprint. We fingerprint all of our employees. We're also the district that had one fall through the cracks that I hope was the impetus for the development of this bill. So I'm very supportive of it for all the reasons that have already been mentioned. And one additional one, we fingerprint, we send in to public safety and the FBI. It takes a minimum of 6 weeks for the results to come back. If the Department of Education were to do this, and certification be dependent upon the fingerprint check, we wouldn't run the risk of having someone in there for 6 weeks or whatever who in fact would be eliminated from receiving his or her certificate. So I think that's the only point that I can think of that wasn't brought up before that I think is important.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions? We're glad you came today, appreciate that. Do we have anything from the Department of Law on this bill? Ms. Otto, or are you interested in this bill at all? Okay, Roxanne, what I have here is, well, we have a quorum, we make an amendment to line one, page 2. We're going to have to look at those two fiscal notes to go with the bill, and then we have to adopt the CS and move the bill. That's what I see as it's, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Senate Bill 228. Senate Bill 228 is relating to civil liability of certain volunteers. Also a Duncan bill. Roxanne, is this yours or is this yours, Dale?
It's Dale's.
Welcome. You get the good ones, I can see. Okay. We have a proposed CS that from Senator Duncan's office, and we have some changes to the proposed CS. So, Dale, why don't you start from the beginning, give the committee for the record an analysis and background of the bill, and then we'll go to public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Dale Staley, aide to Senator Duncan, prime sponsor of Senate Bill 228. Basically, Senate Bill 228 would provide protection from liability for persons who are volunteers through various state agencies, such as the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation and the Department of Natural Resources, and those volunteers for activities within municipalities and certain nonprofit organizations. However, the protection is limited and would preclude a volunteer's liability for damages as a result of gross negligence, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. The Department of Natural Resources may be one of the largest users of volunteer force. They use better than 60,000 hours of volunteer work every year,
parks.
I think. Many municipalities use them in their parks activities also. The problem that we're finding, I think, is that a good number of the volunteer force diminishes rapidly when they find that they have a potential for a loss of personal assets through litigation and some of their activities as a volunteer. Senate Bill 228 would allow the state municipalities and certain nonprofits to offer more recreational opportunities and attract more volunteers to assist them in their offerings. And I think if you check in your file, you'll find that you have resolutions of support from the Alaska Municipal League, the Alaska Recreation and Parks Association, as well as a statement from the Alaska Outdoor Council Incorporated.
Okay, Dale, my question to you is, what if a state or a nonprofit hires a professional on a one-time contract for less than $500, say an expert witness at a trial, a nurse to administer vaccinations for a day in a village, or an exterminator to take out bugs from a building on a one-shot deal? Basically, they would be earning under your ceiling, but they're being paid for a specific job and being hired for a specific job as a professional, not as a volunteer.
That's true.
Do we have a problem here?
It was my feeling that we did. It was the Attorney General's office belief that there may be a problem there, as well as the fact that I guess initially that problem or potential problem was pointed out from the Department of Natural Resources. We discussed it with legislative drafting, and they didn't believe that there was a problem that needed to be addressed in that respect. I think Senator Duncan would be very receptive to some language that anyone might be willing to propose that could help straighten that out and make sure that there isn't a misunderstanding of the definition of a volunteer due to the source of their normal work.
I would think that you folks would want to work with Ms. Otto and Mr. Christensen in coming up with language, because just knowing the committee with the few months that we've had together, and more specifically the action on the floor, when this type of question hits the floor, it would behoove Senator Duncan and you folks to get it straightened out now.
Yes, I'm sure.
I would be safer than, more safe than sorry on this. I would go with the Department of Law and Mr. Christensen and try to do that.
Madam Chair, with that, if we get something worked out, you did indicate that there is a proposed committee substitute in a packet. Would it be appropriate to make the change in that proposed committee substitute?
Yes, sir. I would just issue a new committee substitute for the committee's perusal, and then I would include, why are you adding these amendments to the proposed CS? Why don't we talk about that, and then you can just bring us one brand new CS.
Very well. The proposed CS includes what was attached as, it looks like amendments, I guess. Those are the changes from the original version to the CS, okay. And these are recommendations from the Attorney General's office.
Right. Okay. All righty. Dale, thank you very much. Anything
thank
else?
You.
Jim? Is it Dumont?
That's correct. Madam Chair, since you don't have a quorum, there's probably not a lot of time or effort that I need to spend reading a written testimony, but my name is James G. Dumont.
Okay, sir,
I'm representing the Alaska Recreation and Park Association.
All right, if I may tell you, don't feel that because they're not here, we are establishing a record, and each member of the committee will ask for the written record. So they'll read your testimony. They're not here to hear it, but they will be interested in it. So
correct.
Don't shortchange yourself.
Okay. It is in your packet as well.
Okay.
So
all right, great.
There's probably no reason to take your time or the audience's time for that.
All right.
Do you have any questions, Madam Chair? In essence, the Alaska Recreation Park Association does support Senate Bill 228 and urges the committee.
Okay. All right. Ms. Otto, do you have any comments on this bill?
No, I don't. I haven't looked at it, and it probably would be Mr. Mello and Ms. Cox who work on board issues that would probably have better information than I.
Okay. All right. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Okay. I think we have found, or at least identified, a bit of a loophole that needs to be closed in. I know Senator Halpert, for one, will have problems with that. All right. Moving right along. This is neat. At least they don't talk back to me when they're not here. Okay. Another Duncan bill, an act related to liability for damage or injury resulting from hazardous recreational activities. Mr. Staley, are you doing this one too?
Yes, Madam Chairman. For the record, again, I am Dale Staley, assistant to Senator Duncan, prime sponsor on Senate Bill 229. 229 is a piece of legislation that's introduced, again, to assist the state and municipal governments in avoiding civil liability for damages that may have occurred to a person involved in a hazardous recreational activity on state or municipal property. We find that several communities have restricted some of the recreational activities or offerings that they've had in the past, which were considered to be hazardous recreational activities, due to the fact that they did find themselves with a real problem of exposure to litigation due to injuries that may occur during those activities when the activity was taking place on state or municipal property. And Senate Bill 229, again, is supported by the Alaska Municipal League, the Alaska Recreation and Parks Association. And I think a point of interest is the a part of the analysis on the fiscal note from the Department of Administration indicating that the passage of Senate Bill 229 may save considerable in defense costs should future claims occur.
Okay. What do you mean by hazardous recreational activities? Let's have a laundry list here.
We used to have a laundry list in this measure when it was introduced, I believe, a year and a half ago. The laundry list included such things as ranging from spelunking to motocross.
What was the first thing?
Spelunking.
What's that?
Exploring caves.
Oh, okay.
Motocross, hang gliding, automobile racing, water skiing, anything that could potentially be dangerous.
We are on Senate Bill 229. It's an act relating to liability for damage or injuries resulting from hazardous recreational activities.
It's a terrible bill.
Mr. Staley, I know. Mr. Staley has just given us an overview of the bill. I'm on what's dangerous, what's hazardous recreational activities, and he's going into cave exploring. You have caves in the municipality of Juneau to explore?
We have old mines that can be explored that are on municipal property.
Okay. And how about hang gliding?
There have been a couple instances of persons hang gliding from the mountains around the city.
How about ATV riding?
Quite a bit of that, yes.
Skiing?
Skiing, yes.
Quite a bit of that.
Whitewater kayaking?
Yes.
Okay, what about hiking?
Not necessarily, but when it gets into mountainous territory, it could be considered as hazardous.
What about the bears around?
Or the legislature?
I'm not sure about that.
Bears around when salmon is running.
That may not be quite as much of a hazard. They're aware of the ready food source.
Okay. But what about, you're exempting the state and the municipality from liability. What about the officers of the state? Employees. It seems to me if they can't sue the state because you've taken away that deep pocket, aren't they going to just sue the employee?
It's a protection for the state or municipality for activities that would occur on state property. The state would in a sense, or the municipality, I guess, sanction the activity because the activity was to occur on state property. Through that sanctioning, as I understand it, then the state would be assuming some liability. This legislation proposes to limit the liability that the state or municipality may face from such a permitting activity.
What does the federal government do when it allows hikers on Mount McKinley?
I'm not sure.
And they also allow hikers through Katmai on permitting. I wonder what that liability is.
I'm sorry.
Senator Rohde, do you have any idea?
The federal government has sovereign immunity, and they have, in a number of instances, allowed the federal government to be sued. I can recall no cases that that arise in either of those areas, and no law that would specifically allow for the federal government to be sued on the basis of some theory of inherently dangerous terrain that is federal. However, as long as you ask, I do have an objection to the bill before us because what it does is there's a complete bar for negligence on behalf of the state or the municipality. If a municipal corporation or a state corporation runs a ski area or something like that, and that, I think that's the most likely thing that would happen, if the state or municipality is negligent, unless it's gross negligence, they're not liable. They just simply are negligent in what they do. Someone is injured as a paraplegic. Some legislative staffer, some citizen of Juneau is crippled at Eagle Crest through negligence, and yet they're denied recovery. And that just doesn't seem fair to me.
Remember the issue in Anchorage? Anchorage has more bike trails, miles of bike trails, than any comparable city in the United States of its size. And on one of those bike trails in Anchorage, at the bottom of the hill, there was a metal in your district, at the bottom of Romick Hill, where the bike trail comes down and around and underneath the tunnel and around, there was a metal barrier or a guardrail around it. A friend of mine came down there on his bicycle, I mean an adult, crashed into that guardrail, died, and his widow was able to recover through the negligence of the municipality, through that particular part of the law, a settlement. Now, if this bill were in effect, it seems to me that bike riding on a bike trail in Anchorage down a hill, a steep hill like Romick Hill, could be considered a hazardous recreational activity, and she would not have been able to sue. Now, the question of whether the guardrail was appropriate or not was up to the courts to decide, and the jury decided it wasn't. But this bill would prevent that. It was a tragic accident. And I just feel like the jury said the municipality was at fault there for having that particular metal barrier at the bottom of a hill around a curve, for it was a hazard to bike riders. And this bill would prevent it. So I guess I have the same concerns as Senator Rohde.
Madam Chair, for Senator Rohde, on page 2 of the legislation, paragraph B on line 7, the provisions here, which are the limitation of liability in A4 of this section, do not apply for liability that would otherwise exist for an act of gross negligence by the state or an employee of the state that is the proximate cause of the damage or injury. So I think if you get to the point of proving gross negligence, then there's not a total exemption of liability.
But Dale, in the example that I gave you, it's a real example, there wasn't gross negligence there. You can't say that...
It wasn't reckless conduct.
Yeah.
It was on path. Madam Chairman, I'm familiar with the bike trail, and my boys and I ride it, and I'm familiar with the spot, and it was, very badly done. There was no... reckless misconduct, terribly gross negligence on part of it. It wasn't certainly it didn't approach the intentional level, but right. It was just
poor design.
Bad design. The sort of thing that was waiting to kill or cripple an adult or child.
Yeah, what we have here is Senator Rohde and I aren't prepared to do anything wonderful with this bill today, and it's the kind of bill that will need the full committee to hear it. So, Ms. Otto, are you going to testify on this bill?
No, I'm not.
Is anyone else going to testify on this bill except for Mr. Dumont? Okay. What we might want to do is, you know our concerns, and I think you're going to find that the rest of the committee, in varying degrees, will have similar concerns. So we'll bring it up on Thursday and see what they say. Okay?
Thank you.
You
get the top bill, don't you?
Senator Jones, staff here. Mr. Christensen, will you let Senator Jones know that we are going to bring up his bill? And is Senator Fahrenkamp's staff around? Or Senator Fahrenkamp? Okay. We'll stand at ease for just a few minutes. Are you willing to stay? We have before Senate Bill 275, an act concerning the admissibility and evidence of the DNA prick test in civil and criminal proceedings, and amending a large series of court rules of the Alaska Rules of Evidence. And Senator Jones, this is the first public hearing on the bill. As you can see, we do lack a quorum, but we do want to get you on the record and everything else. Senator Rohde and I feel confident that we'll see our committee members again eventually. Senator.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 275 before the committee now is, we also have a packet of information which gives a history and background of DNA print test. It's the DNA deoxyribonucleic acid test. I'll say that once, Madam Chair, and then from now on we'll call it DNA if it's all right with the Chair. The first murder suspect to be identified and charged solely as a result of DNA analysis was a 27-year-old Briton who in September 1987 was charged with 2 murder rapes after a 4-year investigation. The man's DNA not only singled him out as a suspect, but also cleared another young man who had confessed to the crimes. Forensic scientists are using DNA print tests to positively identify suspects in criminal and paternity cases. I think Alaska prosecutors could benefit a great deal by using this new technique. But there's a small problem. When a new scientific test is used as evidence, it must first meet the so-called Frye standard. The judge must be convinced that the technology involved is sufficiently established to have gained general acceptance in the particular field in which it belongs. What this means is if, say, a prosecutor could positively identify a criminal using DNA print tests, and if this prosecutor introduced this print test as evidence, the evidence would have to go on trial. The prosecutor would have to convince the judge that the print tests have indeed gained general acceptance in the scientific community. This is going on now, but the process is lengthy. Various states across the United States have enacted or are about to enact legislation regarding DNA print tests. What Senate Bill 275 would do is permit the use of DNA print tests as evidence in Alaskan courts without having to go through the extended court testing of the evidence. But the committee has specific legal questions. Lori Otto from the Department of Law, Criminal Division, is here to testify, and also Jack Chenoweth is here to answer questions. We also have research analyst Sheila. None of these people are here?
Jack's not here.
All right. Sheila and Lori are here. So with that, I think I'll leave the technical side to them. If you have any questions, I'm sure you might.
Questions for the prime sponsor? Thank you, Senator Jones. You may join us at the table. There's lots of space. Ms. Otto?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Rota. For the record, my name is Lori Otto. I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As I think Senator Jones explained fairly clearly, under existing law, when the prosecution seeks to introduce evidence of a test that's based on a scientific technique that has not been used before, the state needs to show that the test itself is accepted in the scientific community. And that involves us calling expert witnesses to testify, not just about the particular test results in the case that's being tried, but also it involves calling scientists to testify that the techniques that were used and the test itself are accepted within the scientific community. Since we don't have people for DNA testing in the state of Alaska who are qualified to testify to that end, it then becomes an expensive process for us to locate witnesses, expert witnesses outside, and bring them up to Alaska to talk about the reliability of the test. What this bill does is have the legislature determine that this particular test is reliable, and then, as the legislature has done with breathalyzer and intoximeter testing, say that the test is presumed to be reliable if it's done according to approved methods. And so in that context, it makes it easier for us to get the evidence introduced. We still would need to call an expert witness. It doesn't eliminate that, but it does eliminate calling expert witnesses to certify that the test itself is accepted in the scientific community. Because the legislation then, in a sense, circumvents the judicial finding that the test is reliable, I think it's important for the legislature to have information on the record showing that, in fact, this kind of test is reliable and accepted within the scientific community. And I know that Dr. Helgen has a lot of articles that say precisely that. One of the interesting things about DNA testing is that the tests were really developed by geneticists for geneticists and not by people in the criminal law area trying to develop ways of testing criminal evidence. And so because of the context in which the test was developed, there's a tremendous amount of information showing that it is reliable and has gone through a fairly lengthy process of testing and in fact is generally accepted within the scientific community. So we think that the evidence exists and is available to be put in the record before you that this kind of test would meet what's called the Frye standard, which is Frye is the name of the test that originally set up that needed to be shown for scientific testing. So we think it would be helpful if that were on the record. I do have...
So what you're saying, Ms. Otto, is we need for sure to have a committee substitute prepared for this bill with a finding section in it establishing the validity of the DNA testing.
That would probably be helpful, yes, and I've suggested that, I think, before.
Okay, I think the prime sponsor then needs to take that to heart.
Then everybody, the first page of the bill with some changes made in it. Those are really all technical changes to conform to what we think is necessary for the test to be admissible. In other words, if you look at the first one, it says the presumption that the DNA print test results are valid rather than just the test. I mean, what we really are talking about is the test results.
Okay, what you're saying now is the alcohol breathalyzer test is no longer a question of whether it's valid or not. It's admitted into evidence as a matter of course, right?
Because there's a statute that
allows it to be admitted.
Yes, and the language that I've added is all patterned after 2835.033, which is the alcohol breathalyzer presumption statute.
Okay. Mr. Chenoweth, Ms. Otto just quickly made some recommendations for a CS Plus. I don't know if you were in here when she mentioned it or not. The Department of Law really recommends we have a finding section in the bill spelling out why we feel DNA testing is valid and should be authorized in the state of Alaska. So we need to work on a fairly extensive finding section, I would believe, and then the committee would have to have hearings set up to go over those findings with the appropriate expert witnesses to do that. Yes, sir.
I would suggest, Madam Chairman, that that we have a brief put together, not unlike Ms. Otto did for Senator Binkley on the alcohol question, that you know, very clearly.
And she recommended for the marijuana question.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
Ms. Otto.
If I may, there is a little bit of a difference, and that is both with alcohol and marijuana, we're talking about a different kind of constitutional analysis than I think is involved here. All we're talking about here is the admissibility of evidence, and I mostly think that it's important that the legislature be able to show that it was responding rationally to a particular situation.
Well,
and I frankly think that if you have the articles that Dr. Helgeth has and findings that are supported in the articles, it would be my opinion that that would be adequate.
Okay.
The final point that I would make is the Department of Law is of the opinion that it's not necessary to have the court rules changes in here that are in Section 3 and Section 4. We spent a fair amount of time looking at that particular issue. I also spoke to Bill Cotton today, who is the court rules attorney, and he agrees that it's not necessary to amend the court rules in this particular bill, but the legislature has the authority to develop this kind of presumption and statute independent of the court rules and what the court rules say about admissibility of evidence.
Yes, we called also, and it was going to be my recommendation to the prime sponsor, that when the CS is drafted, that the title be changed and the reference to the court rules be stricken. Senator Rohde, any more comments that you would like to see further work done and brought back? Okay, when the prime sponsor with the Department of Law has the CS prepared for the committee, we will take it up, knowing that, Doctor, do you wish to testify now or do you want to wait until we do the findings? Okay, Ms. Horetzky?
Only if there are questions.
Any questions for Ms. Horetzky? Ms.
Horetzky, well, actually, just a general question. How, I've been watching, like many people have, DNA analysis over the past 20 years, and how long has it been used as an identification? How long has the technique been perfected to the point where it can be used for identification?
The technique is actually quite well developed, and it's used in two or three different medical professions. It's used by a lot of population biologists, and also in the forensics. As far as being developed for forensic sciences since 1985, but the techniques have been in existence before that time. It's a fairly rapidly evolving technique, but as far as scientific validity, which means that you're measuring, if you're trying to measure apples, you're really measuring apples, and reliability, can you be sure that that's what you've got? It's a far better technique, a far more precise technique than, say, blood testing.
Okay.
which is standardly accepted as evidence. As it's been explained to me, you can be about 95% sure with a blood test. Depending on which test you use with the DNA fingerprinting, you can be up as sure as 1 in 3 billion, which is not about that people on Earth. It's an identical match as opposed to excluding people.
So since 1985, it's been used for forensic purposes.
Senator Rohde, my problem is that no other state has done this quite like Senate Bill 275 does it. There have been 4 states, Alabama, New York, Florida, and Maryland, where they have appellate court rulings that allow DNA identification and the admissibility of that evidence. So this is a very major big step for the state of Alaska, and if we're going to go first, we want to make sure we do it as carefully and over cautiously as possible, I think, as an example.
They don't have a senator like Senator Jones either.
All right, is there any other questions or comments?
Just a comment, it might be worthwhile to notify the Bar Association, the criminal law section of the Bar, and ask if they have any, have Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Christensen, Senator Rohde is requesting that on this particular bill, the criminal section of the Bar Association be notified. Criminal law section of the Bar Association be notified to see if they have any comments or questions about this. Okay, any other comments, Mr. Chenoweth? Do you have anything, sir? All right, Senator Jones, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
The last bill before us today is Senate Joint Resolution number 43. It's relating to the implementation by Congress of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The prime sponsor, Senator Fahrenkamp, is with us today. Senator, I know it looks like we don't have a quorum. Senator Rohde and I have been doing very nicely.
I have a bill up.
And he's got a bill up. But what we want to do is establish the record, have written testimony given to the various committee members who are all off doing other things, and then we'll bring you back up Thursday and I'll go over the preliminary with them, but we've established you've had your first public hearing, and we're going to try to keep the bill moving is what we're going to do, and Senator Rohde will be back, but we lost our quorum an hour ago, but that hasn't stopped us. We've continued.
Good for you.
All
we
right.
have to do that occasionally too. Well,
sure.
For the record, my name is Betty Fahrenkamp. I represent District K. And Madam Chairman, I feel, or rather, I'm discussing this legislation that you know as well as I do in front of you. But for the record, the committee does have a copy of the reason for it. They have a copy of the 10th Amendment that we're addressing. And just to put on the record that the Council of State Governments annual meeting, the Executive Committee took action urging governing Council of Governing Board members in each state to adopt a resolution affirming the substantive and operational effects of the 10th Amendment on the United States Constitution. And this request, this is in your packets, stems from recent court case decisions. You have copies of that, 2 Supreme Court decisions, there, Garcia versus San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority and South Carolina versus Baker. And we all know that as we work with governments, that the fight continually goes on as to what parts of running government should be allocated to the states and what parts are allocated to the federal government. And the 10th Amendment is that amendment that allocates and gives the states the authorities that they have to handle the state's businesses. So with that, Madam Chairman, I just urge that with the information the committee has and any further information they need or that I can do on Thursday or whenever the next meeting is, that we do see it pass out right away so that all the members of the Council of State Government, which are every state in the Union, as you know, plus the territories and the Commonwealth, know that we are working together hand in hand, as we do in those groups, on those things in which we agree to see that every state carries its share of the load in trying to impress Congress with the fact that we would like to have the Constitution upheld and the states' rights under that Constitution upheld. And that's the reason for this.
Okay, Senator, I really appreciate you testifying, and especially under these conditions. Mr. Christensen, let's be sure to flag this so that as soon as we have a quorum on Thursday or whenever we get this thing out of here, I'm very supportive of what Senator Fahrenkamp and the National Council of State Legislatures is trying to do. So we'll move it as soon as we have the votes to move it, Senator.
I appreciate that, Madam Chairman.
Okay, great. Any other business coming for the Judiciary Committee? Mr.
Christensen?
We are adjourned. Oh, jeez.